Today is the fifth day and the end of the first week in the homicide trial of Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse. Last year, Rittenhouse traveled from Antioch to Kenosha during protests following Jacob Blake's shooting by police. He's charged with killing two people and injuring a third. We're going to get the latest on the trial itself and then take a look a little wider about some of the likely ramifications of the jury's ultimate decision. And we want to hear from you on this at 1-800-642-1234. Have you been following the trial this week? And if so, what stood out to you? If you haven't been following the trial, what would you like to have updated or clarified? Have you ever served on a jury in a homicide case, and what would that experience have been like? You can call us, 1-800-642-1234. You can drop us a line on our Ideas Network Facebook page or email us, ideas@wpr.org. Let's begin by bringing in Corinne Hess, WPR reporter from Milwaukee in southeast Wisconsin. She's been covering the trial for WPR and NPR. Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
As the trial began this week, could you take us back to the opening arguments of the prosecution and the defense?
Yes, when it began, both sides were just laying out what they're going to be presenting over these next 2 weeks. And really what it is the prosecution is trying to characterize Kyle Rittenhouse as this violent, trigger-happy vigilante who came to Kenosha and killed Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber and wounded Gage Grosskreutz. And the defense is, presenting this same young man as a concerned citizen who came to Kenosha to try to protect a community after two nights of violent protests.
And as the case got underway, as we heard from Brady Carlson in the news, there has been some video evidence presented and there has been some testimony this week. Corey, what stood out to you?
Like you just mentioned, the video has really been the star of the trial this week. Jurors have been watching these videos almost endlessly. And they're showing Mr. Rittenhouse sort of throughout this chaotic night of August 25th, 2020. And at times they're really hard to watch. I mean, the videos show the shooting and death of Joseph Rosenbaum. And the prosecution is just trying to show really methodically how Kyle Rittenhouse started out, just sort of walking the streets, and then the night ended in death. And the defense is just kind of trying to hammer home in their cross-examination how he allegedly had to shoot these men because it was self-defense. But just these videos are being shown over and over.
As the week began, we had a selection of 20 jurors, which will, as I understand it, be boiled down to 12 ultimately, who will decide the fate of Kyle Rittenhouse. But we have lost a couple of jurors in the last couple of days. Corey Hess, what can you tell us about that?
Yes. So yesterday morning, one of the jurors was dismissed after telling an off-color joke about Jacob Blake. Jacob Blake, of course, is the man who was shot by Kenosha police 7 times and is now paralyzed. So this man was telling a joke to another law enforcement official there about that, and he was dismissed. And then this morning, a juror was she asked to leave. She's pregnant, and she was saying that she was having some issues, so she went home. When all of this started, the jury was sat in just one day, which is pretty unusual. And there's 8 alternates, and so that seemed like a lot, but, 2 are already gone, so maybe it wasn't too many.
And Corey, you've been covering this trial for NPR as well as Wisconsin Public Radio, and what is the national spotlight here? Why is NPR focusing on this case?
Well, I think the nation is focusing on this case because of just how much video there was with both the Jacob Blake shooting and then the Kyle Rittenhouse shootings. All of this was captured on amateur cell phone video by the protesters and journalists that were there that night, and all of that was put on social media. So much of this has been seen, and so many people think that they know so much already about this case and have made their minds up. Also, this case became political. Both President Biden and then President Trump were campaigning at the time and weighed in on this. Well, especially President Trump did, and then Joe Biden also talked about it. Both visited Kenosha. So this really had a whole national spin to it last year. And what's interesting is that a lot of people are talking about it nationally, but in Kenosha, you know, nobody's coming to the courthouse during the day to watch this. And there's nobody outside protesting or anything that was really anticipated before the trial. So it feels like in Kenosha, a lot of people want to put this chapter behind them and just move on from it.
Interesting. And Corey, how long is this case expected to go on? What are you expecting to come next week?
Well, on Monday, Gage Grosskreutz, which is, again, the man who was shot and wounded by Kyle Rittenhouse, will testify. And the prosecution has said that they're planning to wrap up on Tuesday. And then the court has said that they're anticipating a little over 2 weeks. So that could put us at maybe, you know, November 16th, 17th. But, you know, it's anybody's guess, really.
Well, and then how long the jury deliberations may go on.
Exactly.
Yeah. Corey, thank you so much for the latest this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Corinne Hess covering Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin for us, and she's been covering the Rittenhouse trial for Wisconsin Public Radio and National Public Radio. Now let's bring in Cecilia Klingel, an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. Cecilia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to expand beyond the Rittenhouse trial, but to start, what have been some of your initial takeaways from what's happened in the courtroom this week?
Well, to the degree I've been able to follow the details, I think mostly what is of interest is how much this is really capturing people's minds. To some degree, the story of police violence, protests against it, protection of community, is this story sadly is becoming an old one. And yet we're still seeing a fascination by the public and an engagement and a polarization on how this case ought to play out.
I want to go to the phones here because there is a question. Lou in Ashland joins us. Lou, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. Yeah, he's not even from the city. He's not from the state. He is an outsider. He has no defense for self-defense of his city. It is not his place. The adults in his life have failed him greatly. As children grow, they expect guidance, sound guidance, from their adults in their life, and his parents failed.
Lou, thank you. And so as we look at what's going on in the courtroom, Cecilia, is self-defense, to what degree and in the law do we see self-defense if you're walking into, and knowingly, admittedly walking into what could be harm's way?
So much will depend on the very specific factual context, but the law is very narrowly focused here. In contexts like this, where people are in a public space and they use force against another person, the law is going to focus really narrowly on the interaction that immediately precedes that use of force, asking whether the person using force reasonably believes him or herself to be in danger, and then whether that person reasonably used proportional force in response.
UW-Madison quoted you responding to the trial with a couple of things I wanted to unpack here. First, you said, we want the jury to be a check on the power of the state and to enforce community norms. So when the law requires that force is used reasonably, we want our community to decide what it is that is or isn't reasonable. So with that last part, the idea of a group of normal folks agreeing what is reasonable use of force, how do you think that would apply in the Rittenhouse case, Cecilia?
Well, this is what juries do, right? Juries sort out for us competing facts, but they also exercise their moral judgment around what we as a community think is appropriate when the law ties the legality of our behavior to reasonable action. So in this case, as I said, really the fundamental question is whether the defendant believed himself to be in danger of death or great bodily harm, and whether in using lethal force himself, he was using the force that was appropriate under the circumstances. And reasonableness is a question about our values and our judgment. And so we ask ordinary people from the county where the crime was committed, allegedly, and where the trial is being held, to exercise their judgment about whether his behavior was reasonable under the circumstances. And the real challenge here is that we are living at a time and in a climate where people are very deeply divided on the reasonableness of behavior like that is being discussed in the courtroom today.
The reasonableness of the behavior of Kyle Rittenhouse on trial in Kenosha. Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. We want to hear about what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Do you believe in the ability of juries to form consensus on a community norm? Do you believe in the credibility of a verdict reached by a jury, and what ramifications might that verdict have reverberating across Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation with Cecilia Klingel about the Kyle Rittenhouse trial continues next on Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is the Ideas Network. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation with Cecilia Klingel, associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and we're taking a look at the use of force, the function of juries, in this week's homicide trial of Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234, where Troy is standing by in Muskego. Troy, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Hello.
Hey, what do you think?
Yes. So my thing is, you know, whole take on this is, you know, this is a prime example of white privilege to me. You know, you got somebody, you know, you got the day that you would see a black parent say, hey, get this full assault rifle, go to another state and walk around with it. And when they have to talk to their kids about putting their hands on the steering wheel so they don't get shot, right? So then you get a white kid that walks around in a crowd with a full assault rifle, walks right past the SWAT team, and right away, he's assumed to be a good guy when he just murdered somebody. And to me, it's just a prime example of that. You know, you would never see that you know, this would never even, if that was a black child, he would have probably got shot walking 5 feet, in that crowd with a rifle.
It sounds like it goes to the heart of reasonableness, which our guest, Cecilia Klingel, says is the charge that the jury is charged with having to find and decide. So, Cecilia, when it comes to deciding reasonableness at this jury, are there ramifications that will expand beyond whatever verdict they decide? Will we be redefining what self-defense may look like in Wisconsin, or setting some standard going forward?
That's a really great question. And both of the last two callers really want to zoom out to the larger context in which the defendant used force that night. And that makes sense, because we're all interested as parents and as citizens in the way people are behaving in our communities. But when we talk about reasonableness in the context of self-defense and what the jury is going to be asked to decide, they're not asked to decide whether it was reasonable for the defendant to be in Kenosha that night, or whether it was reasonable for his parents to support his behavior. They're only going to be asked if he was reasonable at the moment he used force in assessing that he was at that moment in danger of death or great bodily harm, and that using lethal force was appropriate under those circumstances in order to protect himself. That's all the jury gets to decide. They don't get to weigh in on these larger questions, important though they may be.
And yet, does that decision from the jury reverberate throughout Wisconsin in defining what self-defense may look like going forward?
This certainly will give us one more factual context, a story in which we can decide that force was found by a particular jury to be appropriate or not appropriate under the circumstances, reasonable or not. But generally, in cases of self-defense, we're looking at very unique factual circumstances. And quite frankly, even in the Rittenhouse case, the jury is going to be making several determinations about reasonableness for every single criminal count in which the defendant is raising a self-defense claim. The jury has to look at the particular interactions that preceded the use of force individually, person by person, use of force by use of force, and make a separate decision, which makes, I think, the broader impact of this decision more limited.
Let's go to Linda in Black Earth. Linda, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Yes, hi. I'm so upset I can hardly speak. I don't think I heard anybody say anything at all about the fact that this was a 17-year-old underage person coming from out of state with an AK-15 assault-type rifle that should only be allowed to be used in wars. Is nobody talking about the fact that he was a minor? Isn't it against the law for a 17-year-old to carry a weapon?
It's not charged with that, as far as I understand, Cecilia.
Right. I mean, I think that you raise a whole bunch of really important questions, but that are outside the scope of what the jury is being asked to do. So one issue is weapons laws. What are the laws about who can possess what kinds of weapons? The other is his age. And I think it's important for us to note here that Wisconsin is one of the few states in the country where once you turn 17, you are treated as an adult for criminal charging purposes, even though you can still be considered a child victim for some kinds of crimes. So we have a defendant here who at 17, any behavior that occurs is going to be charged as adult criminal behavior. And that is unique to Wisconsin law.
Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. Our guest as we take a look at the first week of the trial for Kyle Rittenhouse and what that means for all of us. And one of the themes of today's show seems to be the polarization of us, just us, our communities. And I wonder from your perspective, Cecilia, how you think that's changed, if at all, the work of juries?
In some ways, in an ideal circumstances, this gives juries the best opportunity to come together as representatives of our communities with very different ideas and to really hash out what it is that we think should define what reasonable behavior looks like. Again, that's ideal. We won't know what happens in that jury room. Jury deliberations are private. We don't get to hear or see what's going on in that space. It might be democracy at its best. It might, though, be a really fraught conversation, depending on how much common ground people are able to find.
As Corey Hess reports at WPR.org, there is one misdemeanor count charged against Kyle Rittenhouse for possession of a dangerous weapon by a minor. But that is just a charge at this time, and we'll see what happens going forward. And with that in mind, Cecilia, I'd look for some tips from you about how to improve our trial following literacy. How can, and as you mentioned, the scope of the jury is going to be pretty specific and at large. As we've heard from the callers, it wants to be pretty broad. How can we watch this trial going forward smartly?
That's a great question. I think that coverage like this that focuses on the difference between community concerns and community conversations over broad issues like gun laws and protests and the involvement of minors in activities of this sort. Those are great conversations for us to be having in our communities. And it is also important for us to understand the divide between those considerations and the more narrow and focused considerations that are going on in the courtroom this week. People are likely to be dissatisfied if they don't understand the work that's really happening, which is trying to decide whether that jury is persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant here actually committed each of the crimes with which he is charged.
So what will you be watching most closely as this Rittenhouse trial continues into the next week and begins to look towards wrapping up?
I'm, I guess, most interested in the outcome of the case. I'm interested in seeing how the jury sorts through the competing charges in which self-defense has been raised to see if there's a pattern and consistency in the way that they're applying the law across those different counts.
And one of the things that has come up in this case so far is the judge saying that the those that were killed or injured by Kyle Rittenhouse could not be considered victims. How common is that in a criminal case like this, Cecilia?
So I don't have empirical data to tell me how many judges have that as a courtroom rule. My understanding is that this judge applies that consistently across cases, and it's certainly not an uncommon position for judges to take, that until we have sorted the facts out and a jury has decided whether or not a crime has been committed, that in a legal way of speaking, we don't yet know whether there are victims of crimes, because we don't know if there is a crime. That, of course, isn't the way that ordinary people talk about these things, but in courtrooms, it's not that unusual.
And that will be for the jury to decide, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Hey, Cecilia, thank you so much for your knowledge this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Cecilia Klingel is an associate professor at the University of Wisconsin Law School, where she teaches on topics including criminal law and sentencing. And we talked with her today about her reactions to the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and got some of your thoughts as well about how what this means at large.